You should have an extra handout today. That's this thing. And that's a signal that we're coming up on a test. So a week from today, we'll have our first test in the class. And I mentioned when I was describing to you how you're graded and all of that in the very first lecture, the general format for tests. Let me just briefly remind you of that, and then I'll talk a little more about it on Thursday. But the general format is that there are three parts. The first part is slide identification. So every time when you get your little sheet like this, it tells you all the buildings and all the architects, and those are the only ones you're responsible for. If I show other things, you don't have to pay any attention. If I don't get to some of those in class, you just scratch it off. You don't have to worry about it. But those are the ones you're responsible for. So you should know, you know, that the Guggenheim Museum in New York was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. You don't have to worry about the date. I'm not going to ask you the date. But you need to know Guggenheim Museum, New York, Frank Lloyd Wright. I need to know what that is. You can't talk about architecture. You can't even think about architecture unless you've got a little vocabulary. So this is just testing your vocabulary. 20 points on the test. Yes, question. Not really location. What I'll do is there will be a sheet on the top of your test, and it will have a list of all the names of the buildings, and it will have a list of all the names of the architects. So you don't have to know how to spell them or anything like that. Slide goes up. All you have to do is pick the name of the building from one list and the name of the architect from the other list. 1 point for the building, 1 point for the architect, 10 slides, 20 points. Easy. Generally, this is like a giveaway to your generation. You guys are so good in terms of visual memory. 15 years ago, give exactly the same drill, and I got a good bell curve. These days, now I'm not saying don't study. You have to study to do this, but you guys have phenomenal visual memory because you've been playing too many video games and stuff like that. But anyway, generally, people will, half the class will get 100% on that one. So that's the first part. Second part is and have the lectures, class stuff. And I'll give you a few extra little tips on how to study for those on Thursday. And then the third part is essay questions, and I will ask you two of those four questions. You don't have any idea which one. If you think you're going to get clever and figure out which one I'm going to ask, if you go back over every test I have given for the last 30 years and you psych out exactly which ones I'm going to ask, you'll be wrong. So you better prepare all four because you have no idea which two I'm going to ask. But that means you go out, and I am totally happy with you doing this in groups. This is, you know, share information, talk about it. If you have a friend who was in the class last year, ask them, talk to them, get all the information you possibly can. And then when you come into class, you can't have any notes or anything like that, just what's in your head, and you write an essay on those. Those you can start anytime. Gorgeous weather, nice time of year, go around, look at the campus, fantastic fun, not like studying for a test at all, right? Just looking at architecture. Who could have more fun than that? Okay, so that's the third part of the test. So I'll talk more about that on Thursday. At the beginning here, I want to go over the Twitter card responses from last time. We had that film on Frank Gehry. The prior time we talked about Frank Gehry at the end of that discussion on organic sources of form. Definitely a guy who taps into organic sources of form. I think that film depicts way better than I can what this human being is like and you know, how he does, how he works. So that's a really great opportunity to get an insight into the way this guy's head works. And I think it's perfectly legit that some of you think that stuff is pure shit. The work is shit, the idea is shit, Frank Gehry's a shithead. There's some of you that's your response. That's cool. I told you at the beginning, this is not, black and white. You should have your own perceptions about this. And then some people will think that Frank Gehry is the coolest thing since forever, and he's incredibly innovative, super creative, what a great artist, an amazing architect. With some values would judge a building one way, and people with different values would judge it a different way. This is legit. That's why we have VAPA requirements. That's why we have arts requirements, because it reminds us that the world is not just about straightforward black and white factual material. It's based on perceptions, it's based on values, and it's inevitable in the arts. So in your little haikus, I noticed some of you had great affection for Frank Gehry and his work, and some of you were not so complimentary. So let's read a little bit of each. These are the ones that like the guy. Bold, bright, and fearless, he makes whatever he wants, and I'm so jealous. Someone else says, never be content. If it is good, it can be great. And there aren't any rules. Somebody else says, Frank Gehry, artist, shapeshifter, and poet that pushes boundaries. Somebody else says, scribbles start it all. Models are to be broken. And when it's all done, it awes. Some people were not so positive. Someone says, artist, architect, troubled man made a new form. Talent is trouble. Someone else says, Frank Gehry is weird. He makes obnoxious buildings. Isabel agrees. Someone else says, he's an architect. He's just a little crazy. I could do his job. Somebody else says, what are you doing? That looks like crumpled paper. Oh, that's just art. So that was, I think, the really, really appropriate, good response to what we were looking at last time. So now we're going to shift. I told you that lecture on organic sources of form was part of a pair. So where does architectural form come from? Partly it comes from organic, nature, those sources of form, and we could see how that works. Today we're looking at quite a different source of form in numbers, mathematics, and geometry. And this is again a long-standing and kind of prevalent source of form in architecture. So I'm going to start this discussion by telling you a little story. This is a story about a guy named Fibonacci, F-I-B-O-N-A-C-C-I, F-I-B-O-N-A-C-C-I, Fibonacci. He's an Italian dude. He lived in the 13th century. The name Fibonacci, actually, in Italian, it means son of a simpleton. Now, it didn't mean that his father was stupid. What it meant was that Fibonacci was so incredibly brilliant that he made his father look like a simpleton. And he was an amazingly brilliant human being. So in 1202, at the age of 27, Fibonacci published a book called Liber Abaci, which means Arabic book, Liber Abaci. And in that book, he introduced Arabic numbers to the Western world. And he understood, as a mathematician, the importance of going to Arabic numbers instead of Roman numerals. Roman numerals were what the Western world had used up to that point. And he saw, in an incredibly prescient way, that we needed to use numbers to manipulate and solve problems. And that as long as you're writing numbers like XVIII or LVIII, that you try to add LVIII and XIII, this is cumbersome. Incredibly cumbersome, and in fact, you just can't manipulate Roman numerals. And the freaking Arabs were so damn smart, they'd figured out a numerical system that was much easier to do calculation, to do arithmetic. And Fibonacci figured that out, and in this book he advocates that the entire Western world shift from Roman numerals to Arabic numbers. And it did. I mean, he was hugely, hugely influential. And the whole development of science and engineering and all those kinds of things would have been so much more difficult if it hadn't been for that brilliant contribution that Fibonacci made. So he was definitely into numbers, mathematics, geometry. But he was into them also in a kind of interesting, not such a practical way. He felt like there was value in certain numbers and relationships that gave them a kind of mystical quality. So he is well known for developing this sequence of numbers that we call the Fibonacci series. And this is how he described his discovery of the Fibonacci series. So he gave himself a word problem. A word problem is we've got a pair of rabbits, a male and a female. And the rules are that the rabbits can produce a pair of offspring every month. But that when a new pair of rabbits is born, there's a month of them growing up before they can bear a pair of offspring. So given those rules, tell me how many pairs of rabbits you'll have in the first month, the second month, the third month, the fourth month, all the way up to a year. And that's the word problem. So in the first month, obviously, there's one pair of rabbits. In the second month, that pair of rabbits has an offspring. So in the second month, there's two pairs of rabbits. In the third month, the original pair has an offspring, but the pair that was born in the second month, they're still not old enough. So only one more is added. So in the third month, there are three pairs of rabbits. In the fourth month, the two that are now old enough, they're producing pairs, but the one that just was born in the third month, still too young, can't bear a pair of rabbits. So in the fourth month, you get five, two plus the three that were there. So if we take that out to 12 months, that means in the first month, and write this down, first month is one, second month is two, third month is three, then five, then eight, then 13, then 21, then 34, then 55, then 89, then 144, and then 233. And that series of numbers is what's called the Fibonacci series. 1, 2, 5, 8, 13, blah, 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 blah. And it looks like... it looks like a fairly random series of numbers. But in fact, oh my God, this is an incredibly interesting and mystical series of numbers. So one thing is we just, of course, you can develop it by any two numbers, you add them together and it gets the next number. So 1 plus 2 equals 3, 2 plus 3 equals 5, 3 plus 5 equals 8. And you can extend the Fibonacci series ad infinitum. Any next number is equal to the sum of the previous two. And that's how we got it by addition, and that's essentially what the word problem gave us. And you generate that by addition. But there's also an interesting relationship between any number and the prior number. So if we take a number and we divide it by the number past it, we get 0.618034. 0.618034. So again, we can generate this by division. You put 1 over 0.618034 and you multiply it by the number before and you get the number after. So you can get this by addition or you can get this by multiplication. Kind of interesting that way. Okay, then there's all these strange and bizarre things about this relationship, 0.618034 to 1. That is what's known as the golden proportion, also sometimes called the golden mean, also sometimes called phi, P-H-I. Any of you, let's see, what is that book? I forget the name of that book, but it was by a guy named Brown, and it was on super popular book. I'll think of it in a minute. Do what?
Da Vinci Code.
Da Vinci Code. Brilliant. Way to go, dude. So the Da Vinci Code, phi is what he calls it in the Da Vinci Code, and this whole thing was about Leonardo da Vinci and, you know, this mystical relationship of this number phi. So that's all through that book. But it's something that has been through culture for thousands of years. So in Experiencing Architecture, Rasmussen refers to this as the golden proportion, and in his chapter on proportion, he talks about it, but he talks about it in the way the Greeks talked about it. They got it by using a ratio. A is to B as B is to A plus B, and that is the ratio 0.618034 to 1. So the Greeks got it by proportion. We just derived it by addition. You can derive it by multiplication. And the Greeks used it to proportion many, many of their buildings, this golden proportion, 0.618034 to 1. A is to B as B is to A plus B, and that gets you that proportion. So like the Parthenon, many, many Greek buildings are proportioned that way. So it also is used in the Great Pyramids at Giza. The Egyptians, who of course came way before the Greeks, they generally used the proportion 5 to 8, which is two sequential numbers in the Fibonacci series. It's approximately 0.618034 to 1, but not quite. The height of the pyramids at Giza, if you take that 5, then the length of the base is 8, 5 to 8. So they use that proportion in proportioning the pyramids. This is really gets a little spooky, but so if you take the height of the pyramids, and they were extremely, extremely precisely built. The stonework was very exact. And the Egyptians measured things in inches. So the height of the tallest pyramid at Giza is 5,813 inches. 5,813 inches. 5, 8, and 13 being three sequential numbers in the Fibonacci series. And then if you take 5,813 and you use that as the radius of a circle and you get the circumference of the circle, circumference equals pi r squared, then you get a number that is 36,524. Sorry? Okay. Do circumference, which is 2 pi r. This guy is totally keeping me on stack here.
He says there's the Da Vinci Code.
Do what? Okay. I get due credit here. They're a team. Okay. So 36,524 is the circumference of the circle. The number of days in a year are precisely 365.24. So those same digits are, and wow, are you saying way back in Egyptian times they knew exactly how many days there are in a year, which is not 365, that's why we have to have leap year. So, wow, but, and that it is all sort of based back to those Fibonacci numbers. Okay, so that's all kind of spooky. Then the other thing is, of course, we've got these two measuring devices that we've had forever in world culture. We have kilometers and we have miles. And that we could never decide on one or the other. So do you, and if you travel much in Europe or anywhere besides the United States, you're always converting miles to kilometers. So you know a really easy way to do that? Any two numbers in the Fibonacci series will give you the conversion between kilometers and miles. So it's roughly 5 miles equals 8 kilometers. 5 and 8 are two sequential numbers in the Fibonacci series. So if you're traveling around in France and you see that it's 233 kilometers to your destination, that's 144 miles. You know that immediately because 144 and 233 are two sequential numbers in the Fibonacci series. If it's 89 miles to the next town, that means it's 89 kilometers, it's 55 miles. If you're a European and you're traveling around in the United States and you see that it's 21 miles to your destination, then you know that that's 34 kilometers. Wow, that is like spooky. How do these Fibonacci numbers, they're like the Egyptians and the Greeks and the and addition and multiplication. And then it's also kilometers and miles. But it goes even further than that. So there was this psychologist in Germany in the 19th century, a guy named Wilhelm Wundt. And he looked into all of the rectangles that he could find, like books or windows or notepads, anything were rectangles. And he measured all these rectangles in Germany at the time. And he found that the average proportion of those things, which were made by zillions of people, was remarkably close to this golden proportion, 5 to 8. A is to B as B is to A plus B. It was just incredibly prevalent. So then he had Gustav Fechner was the German guy who did that. He had a disciple named Wilhelm Wundt. And Wilhelm Wundt, then he did more tests. And he had people who were subjects, and he would show them all kinds of rectangles and say which is the best proportioned rectangle. And 75% of the people would say it was the golden rectangle. So there's something in us that also has this kind of preference. We think that's visually pleasing, that particular proportion. Now, Wilhelm Wundt was a really important guy. He wrote a book in the 19th century that linked visual perception to the working of our brain. And really, in many ways, he's the father of neuroscience because it was the first time somebody actually said, okay, the way our brain works, the way we perceive this, is built in, it's hardwired. And it began to suggest that maybe there's something in our DNA, in the way we see things physiologically, that gives us a preference for certain numerical relationships that seem more visually pleasing to us, that that's built into our brain. That was a notion he had. Okay, so that's all very interesting about numbers, mathematics, geometry, and visual preference. But let's take it just one step further. Okay, then there also is something called the golden spiral. And I'm going to teach you how to draw a golden spiral here. So get a blank sheet of paper, and then make it pretty big here, but measure out essentially 8 units horizontally across your piece of paper and 5 units vertically. So turn your 8.5 by 11 sheet on its side and make 8 units across the top and 5 units down and make a rectangle that's essentially 8 by 5. Now that's pretty much a golden rectangle. Oh my God, already you guys are slow as molasses. Let's see. 8 units across this way. So if you've got ruled paper, maybe take each ruled line as 3. So you want 24 across the top. And then, you know, you're on your own because you probably don't have gridded paper, and just sort of make about 5 of those units down. So 8 across the top, 5 down. Okay, we're getting there. Now, what I want you to do is on the left-hand side of that, I want you to take a square out. So go 5 units across and put a vertical line down. And that's going to make a 5 by 5 square on the left. And it's going to leave you with a golden rectangle that's vertical on the right. So when you subtract a square from a golden rectangle, you get another golden rectangle. So now, if I lose you, don't worry about it. It's not critical here. But so on that vertical golden rectangle, on the bottom of it, I want you to take out a square there. essentially it's going to be like 3 units by 3 units. But take a square out there, and that's going to leave you with a horizontal golden rectangle at the top of that. And then I want you to take a square out of the right-hand side of that golden rectangle, which will leave you with a vertical golden rectangle on the left-hand side. And you could keep doing this on and on and on, okay? So now take your pencil and put a dot in the center of each square. The big square, the next smallest square, the next smallest square. If you put a dot in each of those squares, and then if you pull out of your pocket your French curve, which I'm sure all of you have with you, but you take a French curve out of your pocket, and then you connect those, it will make a spiral. And that spiral is a golden spiral. Now, tiny plankton are in the shape of a golden spiral. Most snails are in the shape of a golden spiral. Most claws and beaks of birds are in the shape of a golden spiral. The inside of Cape Cod is a golden spiral. The shape of the inside of Cape Cod in Massachusetts is a golden spiral. When you shoot the gap on a wave, the inside of the wave is a golden spiral. So over and over in nature, we see this shape of the golden spiral. Now, the real kind of kicker here is sunflowers. So if you take a sunflower, you know this flower with a big seed pod in the center and then yellow petals all the way around? You take a sunflower, that is two interlocking golden spirals, one clockwise and one counterclockwise. And that's how the seeds are arranged in two interlocking golden spirals. And then if you're very, very patient and you count the number of seeds in each of those golden spirals, you will find that they are two sequential numbers in the Fibonacci series. Holy shit. I mean, that's like, what? So a small sunflower will be 21 seeds in one golden spiral and 34 seeds in the other golden spiral. A medium-sized sunflower will have 34 and 55, and an extremely large sunflower will have 55 and 89, two sequential numbers in the Fibonacci series. Now, all of that in some ways, we could just say, well, that's these crazy mathematical fun and games. But the truth is, this has, through many, many, many centuries, been very interesting to architects. Like, there's something special about certain numbers and certain proportions. And that, when embedded in buildings, makes buildings that are more desirable than other buildings. So let's do a little looking at implications. Now, all of this is to say that there is this idea in architecture that there are certain numbers that are mystical. They have power. And that those numbers generate certain shapes and forms and proportions that likewise have power. There is a mysticism in numbers, mathematics, and geometry that gives specialness to a building. Now, that's one reason for using numbers, mathematics, and geometry, but there are other reasons as well. There is something in these geometric and numerical relationships that give prestige to a building. So another reason why we use these forms is because they lend prestige, and we'll look at some examples of that. Then a third reason is it turns out those very same forms make structural sense. They actually are the efficient use of materials to span distances and to make structural efficiency. So just like there's that weird coincidence with all these Fibonacci numbers, there is this coincidence between what makes an efficient structure and what has these numerical relationships that tend to seem special in numbers and geometry. A fourth reason we use it is there is something about these forms that becomes iconic, that draws our eye to it, that we focus on it. And that's just, again, in our neurological perceptions. And then the fifth reason why we might use numbers, mathematics, and geometry is sometimes they can create these intellectual puzzles. And we talked about a couple of lectures ago this intellectual reasons for using form. They make us think. They communicate something. And numbers are a good mechanism for doing that as well. So we'll look through each of these five things and how you make architecture out of these characteristics of numbers, mathematics, and geometry. So let's talk about this mysticism thing for a bit and how it works its way into buildings. I briefly mentioned the pyramids. Oh my God, this is freaking weird. It took hundreds of years to build these pyramids. This is a major, major accomplishment of humankind. It's one of the great wonders of the world. Anybody been to the pyramids? They freaking blow you away, don't they? They're way bigger than you think they are. When you get up close to them, they're unbelievable. And to think of all the human effort that went into making what? There's no great interior spaces here. There is no function of this building. This building is just one big freaking piece of geometry. It's just one big mathematical statement. That's what the pyramids are. Hundreds of years, millions of man hours, huge resources of the most powerful empire in the world, all put into making a perfect geometrical form. Why? Because that form was deemed to be mystical. That was going to be a vehicle for taking the freaking Pharaoh to eternity. That was his vehicle to immortality. So in addition to the things we've already talked about, and we talked about the fact that the height compared to the leg here, or the base, is that 5 to 8, two numbers in the Fibonacci series. In addition, each face, of course, is an equilateral triangle. The base is, of course, a square. They were oriented to the cardinal points, north, south, east, and west, so it put them in a position in the cosmos. All of that was to give this kind of perfection, that these forms, these numerical relationships, these proportions, they were perfect, and they could take the Pharaoh into a perfect eternity. So in addition to that, there's all kinds of these things inside the freaking pyramids. You know, so it's how they laid the stones and how they proportioned, and they're incredibly exact numerical relationships that are all buried inside the pyramid. Not something for you to see, but because it made it perfect, because it made it right, made it transcend circumstantial things in the world and take you right straight to immortality. So, you know, there they are, standing there, thousands and thousands of years later. This is 2500 BC. This is like 4,500 years ago when they started these things. And they still are there as this powerful emblem of Egyptian culture. Now, they initially had this skin on them that, like I said, would have been extremely precise. Beautiful craftsmanship. And incredible to think of that culture having this perfection, this great craftsmanship, right up to a needle point at the top. Now, of course, they're severely worn away, but we can also see how they're constructed because of this. They're in somewhat ruins at the moment. But you can see that these huge blocks of stone, bigger, you know, taller than a person sometimes, and massive blocks of stone. How the hell did they do this? These things, there isn't stone in Giza. The stone comes like 400 miles down the Nile. So they quarried them. They took them to the Nile. They floated them up barges, and then they didn't build the pyramids right by the Nile. It's quite away from the Nile into there. They had to transport those big-ass stones again. And there are all kinds of theories of exactly how they did it and how they figured it out, and all of it with no mechanization, unbelievable enterprise. Why do all this? Just to make that powerful, mystical, perfect geometric shape. Okay, a different kind of application of these ideas to architecture. This is a sketchbook of Leonardo da Vinci. And pretty much everybody has seen that drawing on the right. It's on mugs and t-shirts and it's everywhere. And I think most people look at it and say, whoa, really buff naked dude. You know, that's what this drawing's about, a buff naked dude, right? No, wrong. This is a very careful mathematical and geometrical analysis. And what it's saying is that our body is tied to these sacred numbers and proportions. So he's talking about the fact here that when we stand like this, our height is equal to the span of our arms. And for Michael Phelps, this is not true, but for most of us, our height is equal to the span of our arms. And Leonardo says that then validates the square as a perfect shape, because our body is based on a square that has the same dimension vertically as it does horizontally. And then the other geometry here is our navel, which is where our umbilical cord is tethered to us in the womb. It is the source of life, the umbilical cord at our navel. That is the center. And then if you span your arms and your legs as far as they'll go, from that, that makes the circle with the navel in the center and the arm span describing the circle itself. So go home, get your tape measure out and see whether you've got a perfect body. But in a perfect human body, all of this works. In addition, there are more subtle things within it. So for example, the length of the arm compared to the fingers to the elbow is that golden proportion, 5 to 8. So he's making the argument that also then within our body, there are these proportions that are the right proportions. This is Leonardo, as a scientist, analyzing the body and finding these perfect numerical proportional relationships and geometric shapes. And then from that, in his sketchbooks, he says, well, then what would that imply? Well, if we're going to make a church, if we're going to make a house for God, and we want to make it the most beautiful, the most perfect creation we can make it, we would need to use those characteristics God's most perfect creation has. So you would want to use the circle and the square and the golden proportion. So on the left here, these are sketches that he's making about how you would make a church that had squares and circles superimposed on squares and conglomerates of circles and squares and three-dimensional circles in domes and semi-domes and cubes, and so that it's all of that geometry now making architecture. And in the Renaissance, where they believed that human beings were the perfect creation of God and that we were superior to all other creatures, and we could find in the human body these geometries and these relationships, and then you could translate that into a superior kind of architecture that would translate into the superiority of God. That's the right way to make a church, and that's what he imagined. It was a huge revolution in the Renaissance. So in Rasmussen's book, he shows you the plan of St. Peter's, great Renaissance church. Look at that plan and you see all of Leonardo's ideas embedded in Bramante's plan. That began then the start of what St. Peter's Cathedral is. Many, many other churches in the Renaissance were based on that same idea. Now, that has gone into other eras. In the 18th century, there was an architect named Etienne Boulay, right here. And Newton had made these great scientific discoveries, and Etienne Boulay did a project that he said was a cenotaph for Newton. This would be where Newton would be buried. And how could you take these great discoveries in physics, this kind of window into the universe, into God's universe, this magnificent man who discovered this, how would you commemorate him? Well, you would make a big mausoleum for him like that, and it would be a sphere, and it would then be in a circle, and that's the scale of it. That's the main door. There are these tiny little people there. This would have been huge, huge. It never built, probably never really seriously intended to be built, but to say this is this god of science, how would you commemorate him? You do it in these perfect scientific forms. One of his disciples, a guy named Claude Ledoux, imagined a house where you would think the strongest thoughts. It would be the perfect house. And it also was a sphere just floating there in space. Now, Claude Ledoux got commissioned to do a whole utopian city. This was a big idea in the 19th century. And there were utopian cities in Europe, and there were utopian cities in the United States. And the idea of a utopia was that it would be such a perfect place that society would function exactly right. You would not have crime, you would not have poverty, you would not have ignorance, you would not have dissension. That if you made the most harmonious environment, and then you took the most harmonious people, and you put them together, you could make a culture that was far superior to everything else. So Claude Ledoux was commissioned to design this utopian town. And it was called Chaux. And they started building it. There still are some little bits of it there, but it was never actually completed. But the plan of Chaux, if you're going to make this perfect city, you start with perfect forms. The circle within the circle, and then all of these geometries, the axes, east-west, north-south, and then around, right in the center of the whole thing, was the primary industry of Chaux, which was salt works. It was where there was a salt mine near there. It's where they refined the salt and sent it out to all over the world. Now there again, oh my God, it's the perfect industry for this perfect geometry, because salt, which is also called halite as a mineral, is one of the few minerals that is isometric, meaning that light passes through it in any direction at the same speed. Very unusual in that regard. Also, salt as a crystal, at whatever scale of crystalline quality, is made up of cubes. So the salt works in the center, salt being this perfect geometric mineral, that was a perfect fit. So the salt works is in the center, and then around the edge here are all of the institutions of Chaux. The library, the city hall, the major churches, those kinds of things were in that ring. And then around that were the palaces of the major leaders of the city and so on in concentric rings through the rest of the city. So very utopian notion. And then within it, all of the buildings were also these very strong geometric objects. So even the industrial facilities would have been a square, and then a square within a square, and then axes that made square courtyards, and then pyramids on the corners, everything full of squares. This actually was the mausoleum where everybody's remains would be buried, and it had that great sphere in the center of it, and then all these radial pieces and circles and passages, and that's where all of the bodies would be located. Everything in the whole city was made to these perfect geometries of the square and the circle and golden proportions. He did two schemes for what one of the most important buildings in his mind in the city, which was the Maison de Plaisir, which is the House of Pleasure. He does a similar kind of anatomical analysis. In this scheme, you can see the circles, or you might say balls, right here. And then the sort of shaft, and then the sort of ellipse at the end. And that would have been the sort of public rooms. The Maison de Plaisir, of course, would have been a brothel. And so there were the public rooms, the brothel, and then all the little cottages for little tete-a-tetes around here in that perfect circle. Wasn't enough to just do one scheme, have an alternate scheme for the Maison de Place here, where it's a little more unified. All of these are private boudoir for activities, and then the more social rooms down here, and then the kind of climax, as you might say, at the end is an elliptical room there. So again, these perfect geometries, but finding those in the human body, and in fact in this, you might say, seminal part of the human body that is generating these geometrical forms. Every building, it's all squares. He's very fond of the 9-square grid, dividing it into threes in both directions. Two kind of interesting buildings here. On the right is the keeper of the waterworks. Of course, water is incredibly important for civilization. So as the water comes into the city, the keeper of the waterworks has a house that is this perfect circle, letting the water come in. On the left is the house of the cooper, the guy who makes wheels. Wheels, this incredibly important invention for any kind of industrial activity. That wheel is, of course, the perfect circle. So utility and ethereal form get combined in the same thing. All the way through show, this utopian town, it's all about these sacred geometries. Okay, all of this is to, I don't know, maybe try to convince you that there is something mystical in numbers, mathematics, and geometry. And then when we build with those things, it gives special qualities to the building that maybe make them more harmonious or make them more in sync with who we are as human beings. So that's one reason for mysticism. Another reason, which is in a way maybe complementary, is that maybe from that mysticism, these forms have a certain prestige. They have, it elevates a building to build it out of these pure geometries. So we're going to have two examples here. The first is a library in Stockholm. This was built in the 1920s. The architect is Gunnar Asplund. Rasmussen refers to Gunnar Asplund, a couple of buildings by him in your book. And this is a square in plan with a circle in the center of it. Now, what they're trying to do here is, this was the beginning of public libraries in Sweden. Sweden is a very small country with a very small language. Not many people in the world speak Swedish. There aren't that many books in Swedish, but they're very proud of their language and they're very proud of maintaining it. So these books become a kind of crucible of culture that's embedded in their language. So they're for the first time making a public building that is proclaiming the importance of our language and our books in our capital city. So it's to proclaim that this is an important prestigious function that goes in here. So that's being done by making these two very simple geometries juxtaposed against each other. In plan, you can see here, that's there are three wings of the building. They imply the square here, and then a square of courtyards in between, and then the circle in the center. And the circle is where you enter, and that's the great reading room. And then the squares around the sides are really where the book stacks are and where the secondary rooms are. But the really amazing thing about this is that's it in section, where you come in off the street, and then you go up a stair, and you actually enter that reading room in the center of the room, so that you really get the sense of that circle. You ascend the stair, and by the time you get to the top, you're in the middle of this cylindrical space, and you see all the way around it. Incredibly powerful, kind of, whoa! This is a prestigious thing that we're dealing with here. So in the slide on the right, we would have just ascended the stair, and as we get to the top, there's a chandelier that's here, and we see that rotunda around. Then there are the subsidiary rectilinear rooms around that. It's adding prestige to this function of a library in an emergent kind of literate culture in Stockholm in the 1920s. very similar kind of situation happening in New York in the 1950s. There's a Jewish guy there named Solomon Guggenheim. Solomon Guggenheim was this great lover of art, and in particular, modern art, very revolutionary modern art. So he goes over to Europe and he sees people like Picasso and Leger and these innovative cubist painters that are seeing space in a completely different way, and he starts collecting, in particular the work of Kandinsky and Klee, the great Russian artists, and Picasso and Leger, who were both in Paris at the time. And he acquires this big collection of art. And this is all before these guys are famous, so he gets it for a song. And then he amasses this huge collection. And so then he wants to introduce this collection to the United States. And in the US, there was very little of this kind of art being done. It was considered crap. Basically, people didn't understand it, didn't get it, didn't seem like art to them. So he wants to introduce this new notion of what art could be. So he hires Frank Lloyd Wright, who is the premier architect in the world, but certainly in the United States at the time. Wright's actually quite an old man. The building is under construction when Wright dies at the age of 91. So he's doing this primarily in his 80s and 90s. And he is conceiving this museum that will add prestige to this branch of art that many people don't understand. You're trying to give prestige to this thing that is not accepted. So he does that with a building, and he does it by making these simple geometric forms, these powerful, bold geometric forms to add prestige. So just seeing it from a distance, you see that great circular rotunda. In plan, it is a grid of squares within circles inscribed in the squares at various scales. It then is these two big circular forms down here at the base of each of the two wings of the building, equilateral triangle here, segments of circles in various places. All of the forms in plan derived from these pure geometries of the circle, the square, the equilateral triangle. And then in three dimensions, that great central space with a skylight at the top and this helix running up, a ramp that goes all the way up the building. The idea is that you would take the elevator to the top and then you would very slowly walk down that ramp and view the art as you went down. But this very powerful geometrical experience, you actually end up make the circle with your body as you walk up and down the museum. So the geometry is thoroughly embedded in the building. And really, it's not much more than geometry, kind of like the pyramids. Everything's flat planes, pure planar concrete. It's just the geometry that's there. And sometimes the circle itself in the middle, and then maybe an extension of a segment of the circle to project you out so that you can look into that great space. Inside, outside, it is pure, simple geometry that's adding prestige to that building. Okay, mysticism, that's maybe one reason for numbers, mathematics, and geometry. Prestige, that's a second reason. And certainly we can see how that plays out in various buildings. A third reason is, holy moly, it turns out it actually is super practical to use these forms sometimes. And the example we're going to look at here is the geodesic dome. The geodesic dome is the most efficient structure we know how to make. It gives the maximum span and the maximum enclosure of space for the minimum amount of material. That's the most efficient structure you can make, the maximum amount of volume enclosed with the minimum amount of material. So the dome itself is a very efficient structural form. And then the geodesic dome takes tetrahedral geometry so that you're not making the dome out of a solid, but instead making it out of lots and lots of little linear pieces, in this case, aluminum. and they're forming these tetrahedral shapes. All of this was invented by Buckminster Fuller, the kind of visionary engineer, artist, thinker in the mid-20th century. And this was the U.S. Pavilion at the World's Fair in Montreal in 1967. Now, this was a period when the United States was trying to talk about our superiority in science. We had the big Sputnik war with Russia to send, you know, people into space, and they were ahead of us, and then, bam, we caught up and surpassed them just about at this time. So in the World's Fair, we're emphasizing our technical capability. And the geodesic dome is a beautiful exemplification of that very simple geometry that makes this technically superior, performatively superior, engineered building. Now, in addition to that geometry, it kind of tied itself to the cosmos in two ways. One way is all of these little blackout things in that tetrahedral geometry, there were little shades, and the little shades had photosensors, so that when the sun came out, the shade would close. When the sun went behind a cloud, or when it got dark, the shade would open up, so that it kept the light on the inside of the building relatively constant. So what you're seeing here is one of those moments when the sun is going behind the cloud, and it's transferring from open to shut. And it was an amazing thing when you were in there. The sun would be out, and then it would go behind a cloud, and you just hear click, 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 all those shades closing. And then when the sun came out from behind the cloud, it would go click, 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 all of them would shut down again. It was very interesting and dramatic. Didn't last very long. It was just for the World's Fair, but it was fantastic. And then the other thing that was interesting that sort of tied it to the cosmos is then the biggest exhibit in the whole thing was the space program. So they had the Mercury capsule, one of the Mercury capsules in there. You see these three parachutes. They were tethered to the Mercury capsule, and it was as if the capsule were landing in the middle of this geodesic dome. So the exhibit had to do with our conquering of space. And then, interestingly enough, the physics of how you slow down that capsule as it comes into the atmosphere, you have parachutes, and the parachutes themselves are these spherical forms. So physics just gives you circles, domes, semi-domes. Physics gives you these. The cosmos gives you these planets, you know, patterns of rotation in planetary orbs. It's just practical. It's in the physical world and how it works. So another reason for these mathematical and geometric forms is that it's just practical. It's how the world works. A fourth reason why we might use it. I've noted this business of intellectual puzzles. Mathematics, sometimes we like seeing these relationships and puzzles between pieces and parts. This is an architect named Peter Eisenman. He's still alive and practicing, but he was a young architect in the 1960s when he did all these houses. And he had this notion of a house that, you know, function is stupid. We don't need a house to function. People can live anywhere. They live in caves, they live in tree houses, and people can live anywhere. Function's baloney. What a house should be about is this intellectual stimulation. So he just made houses that were these puzzles, and yeah, you'd figure out how to live in it. So this is, and he did a whole series of these houses, and of course they weren't named the Jones House or the Smith House, as we normally refer to houses for families. These were called House 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I think he got up to about House 16 or 17 before he quit. This one is actually house 2. And so he starts with a square up here, and then he divides it into a 9-square grid like that. And then he notes, okay, well, that could give planes in one direction, or it could give planes in the other direction. At the intersection, there could be columns. Then at a certain point, he does a 3-foot shift, and he shifts it 3 feet one way and 3 feet the other way. And then he has a superimposed two sets of grids on top of each other. And then he starts manipulating those grids and altering them and finding different shapes and forms. He could get 3 of the 9 squares and 2 and 1 and leave over 2 and 1. And then he stacks them and recombines them. And in the end, he makes a house that really is this geometric puzzle made out of all of these squares and shifted squares and pieces and parts made out of that. And in plan, that's sort of the 3-foot shift allowed him to put kind of kitchen cabinets there, allowed him to put a stair there. But basically, it's that 9-square grid with 3 squares, 2 squares, 1 square of the interior, and 2 squares and 1 square on the exterior. And, you know, you figure it out. Living room, dining room, I don't know, whatever. Doesn't really matter. It's about making this kind of geometric object that steps. And that 3-foot shift also happened vertically in the same way in section there. This is house 5, where he shifts it 45 degrees, and the collision of those two geometries make the house. This one is house 6. This one actually got built. Most of them did not get built. And it had a plane sliding in one direction, a plane in the other direction. It had these little cubes. It had all these regulating zones that went through that were the thickness. Sometimes it was a wall, sometimes it was a slot, but it modulated between the various cubes and forms within it. And he's making an architectural form out of this puzzle made out of all these geometric pieces. In the master bedroom, there was a slot that went right through the middle of the room right here. And it was open completely. Well, of course, you couldn't put a king-size bed in the master bedroom because the slot was very important. So that meant the husband and wife had to sleep on twin beds. That was mandated by the house. And it was originally a slot so that when you crawled out of bed, you might end up with one leg down in the living room and, you know, crotch busted. And so it was like a really, you know, it was a little dangerous. So they did end up putting plexiglass in that, which was a compromise. This is very interesting. On the left, there was a form that you could go to the second floor. We don't call that a stairway because that sounds functional. It's not functional. It's a geometric form that you could climb to get to the second floor. But because of the rotation of the pieces in one of the operations, there then also is an upside down version of that here, painted red. But that's just to make it clear, it's not a functional thing. It's just an operation of geometry. So this is, again, it's an intellectual puzzle that comes out of the architecture. A fifth and final thing that can be done with this is these geometric forms capture our These geometric forms capture our eye in a way that we just focus on them, and they make us want to look that way. So it's possible to use that as a device in architecture, as we're seeing here, where this whole building is a cube. It's actually a new university that they were building in an old industrial part of town in this city in Germany. And in order to set it apart and say, we're not doing business as usual, the old stuff like this industrial town, this is a new university, they made a new building, had these powerful iconic forms that are a cube for the building as a whole. And then each of the elements within the building gets articulated by these square windows, which likewise have that kind of iconic focus quality. And even inside, you're often focusing on some particular window or some particular view, but geometry can be used as an iconic thing that makes us focus a certain place. And that's not this building in a very effective way. So, the last thing we're going to look at is a building that goes beyond
separate pieces of a single country, and they have a capital in each of them. So the capital is in one for 6 months and in the other for 6 months. And this was meant to be the capital of East Pakistan. So the whole site was about this perfect geometric form in a pond that would set it all precisely. A huge sort of secretariat building where all the offices were. This was really where the legislature and the president and all of that were. And then houses for all those legislators and for the president on the side. But everything very strongly built around geometry. Now, this was really all of those things. There is in the culture of this region, this notion of a mandala. A mandala is a geometric form that looks like the one that runs. And in sacred buildings, they would lay out their temples based on a mandala. So this important cultural building gets that kind of mandala form. And it's oriented north, south, east, west. Everything except the mosque, which is tilted to point to Mecca, which is not exactly the piece of the very Mecca. Everything in here, the pentagon, the central building, all of the pieces made of squares, square courtyards within the squares, segments of circles, all of the municipal. But also actually very prestigious. Elevated to a scale and to a power that makes it appropriate for a capital building. In many cases, also very practical, since carrying those loads around big openings. The triangle does that, the arch does that as a part of the circle. So it's being used in practical ways as well. It also makes this just kind of complex geometric puzzle. And it also focuses our eye from time to time, because that constantly slows down. So it's possible to use all of these simple ability to make our minds think and